It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent, and fans of Frontline on PBS Wisconsin, don't miss us tomorrow morning after 7 as we talk to the reporter and filmmaker responsible for tonight's new episode, Plot to Overturn the Election. Watch tonight on PBS Wisconsin at 9, then join us as we go behind the scenes tomorrow morning after 7 here on the morning show. Now, what makes the week what it is? How did society settle on 7 days anyway? We're exploring these questions, the weekly rhythms of life, on the morning show. And the answer, according to one author, lies in hundreds, if not thousands, of years of history. David Henken is an historian at University of California, Berkeley. His new book is called The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. It explores how the 7-day week came to be a cornerstone of our society, no matter where you are. And he recently talked with us about the book and his research. Before we get into the why, David, let's get into why this matters. So from your research, how have you found the 7-day work week affecting us, especially in ways that we might not even realize?
Well, truth is that I was interested not only in the 7-day work week, but all the other things that the week does. And I think that we're attuned to the fact that the 7-day work week gives us a certain kind of discipline, a certain kind of rhythm. And that's interesting just because it's sort of become a pretty much a global timekeeping cycle only really in the last century or so. So that's interesting in its own right. But I was especially interested in how it is that even beyond the rhythms of work and not work, the cycle of 7 different days has come to seem so natural to us. It feels like a part of like the fabric of our lives, the sort of the anchor of our memory and all these other things that go beyond simply the separation between labor and leisure. And when I began this book, I didn't know exactly all the things that it did. And I didn't even know exactly how it had come to do those things. But I was convinced that the 7-day week was a technology that performed all kinds of things for us and performed all sorts of things on us as well.
So, and as you write in the week, in contrast to months and years, a 7-day cycle does not form neat fractional subsets of any larger calendar unit. So what makes the week unique then compared to the other ways we keep track of time?
Well, a couple of things. One is not about its uniqueness, but about its independence. In other words, because the week is not a fraction or a portion of a month or a year or a century or a decade or any of that, it kind of is like this separate calendar with its separate history. We might think of it as part of the Gregorian calendar, but it's much older than the Gregorian calendar. It's been observed by many societies that didn't use the Gregorian calendar, and it has its own rhythms that are independent of it. So that's one thing, is that the week is an independent calendar. And the other is the fact that it's not even suggested really by anything in the observable universe means that it is, we know when we think about it, it's not universal, it's not necessary, it's in some ways arbitrary, and many societies have done just fine without that. And then the final thing I would add is because the week is not a portion of or naturally identified with any observable cycle, it means that it's associated with human memory and human record keeping in a pretty unique way. I mean, if we lost track of other units of time, something in our experience would let us know that we had gotten off track. But the week depends entirely on conventions of human scheduling and conventions of human record keeping, which is one of the reasons why we get so upset when we forget what day of the week it is, because we're aware on some level that the week is a vulnerable timekeeping system. It is vulnerable in the same way that human memory is vulnerable.
Wasn't that one of the experiences of the pandemic for just about all of us, though, was the way that days ran together and us stopping to wonder what is the difference between a Tuesday and a Thursday anyway?
It's a little interesting to me that we focus so much on the week, given the fact that our shutdown experience ought to have confused day and night also, and ought to have confused the times of the year. In some ways, that was the more obvious disruption of our lives. Those of us who were used to spending the day outside the house and the evening inside the house suddenly had spending all time inside the house. And also many annual events like proms or World Series or things like that were affected or postponed by. But instead, we complained about the week, which I took as a sign that we are all very, very much attached to the week above all other calendar units, as the anchors of our habits, and also the anchors of our experience of memory, which I think what your question was suggesting. Yeah.
So as we're all anchored to this week, but the week seems to be arbitrary, at least in the larger calendar units that we use in the bigger picture of things. So David Henken, your new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are, just how unnatural are these rhythms that we've taken for granted? And in the context of the week, what do you mean with these unnatural rhythms?
Well, by unnatural, I just mean that they're really a sort of a conventional technology for how to divide up time. There are lots of conventional technologies for dividing up time, but most of them are rooted in things like the movements of celestial bodies or the tides or patterns of weather or things of that. The week is not, which is why many parts of the world did not observe a continuous cycle of 7-day increments the way that we do. But now that we do, and now that everyone else does, and now that we use it to organize our lives and schedule our activities, it seems quite natural, right? It seems like today really is, in some sense, a Thursday. And if you think it's not a Thursday, and then you discover it is, it throws you because it feels like you had misunderstood something about the natural world, not just something about your schedule.
It sounds like the rest of our technology is built on this ancient technology that we call the week.
We use many techniques and many machines to track time. The week is a weird one because it is an ancient technology. And so we usually think that modern timekeeping is different from ancient timekeeping in various ways. And the week doesn't fit into any of those distinctions. The week is artificial rather than natural, which is the opposite of what we think. We think of the ancient ones as natural and the modern ones as artificial. The week is cyclical, not linear. We don't think of the artificial ones as being cyclical, but this one is. The week is really a kind of outlier, and I do think of it as an ancient technology.
David Henken, our guest here on the Ideas Network. He is a historian at the UC Berkeley and also the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. So, David, your book talks about how the week came to be accepted here in the United States. And it's interesting that you juxtapose Cotton Mather and Benjamin Franklin, who both came up with systems for the 7-day cycle. How did the week become so commonplace across so much of this country?
Okay, so I mean, the very simple answer at how the week came to North America is that Europeans and Africans brought it with them. The people who came to North America, either voluntarily or in chains, in the 16th, 17th, and 18th centuries, were by and large people who were familiar with the week. In the grand scheme of global history, that they weren't necessarily the majority, but they already understood many of the things that the week can do. And both Benjamin Franklin and Cotton Mather, who both essentially were descended from generations of Puritans, were familiar with a particular use of the week to take stock of one's life, to assess how productive one had been, to measure one's shortcomings, to resolve to do better in the next week. Cotton Mather did so within a very sort of classically Puritan theological framework, having to do with duties toward God. Franklin, who was raised in that culture, but came to embrace other ideas about religion, used it in a more sort of familiar secular way as a kind of self-help, moral self-improvement, but both of them thought of the week in that way. My point is that the week has done different things for different people, and in 18th century North America, it was already quite familiar to lots of people, both as a system of dividing labor from leisure and as a technology of taking stock. But what I'm interested in the modern world is the way a very different use of the week has come to take over. So in addition to those two and some others, most of us are anchored to the week by schedules. We use the week as a technique for making plans with friends and for scheduling activities with strangers. And in many ways, that's what makes Tuesday and Wednesday so fundamentally different for each of us, is that we have routines, things that we do every 7 days. or sometimes things we do every 14 days or every 28 days, but things that are attached to particular days because of our schedule. And that's something that most people in the United States didn't do in 1800. But that masses of ordinary people in the United States were already doing by about 1850. So in some ways, that is the birth of a particular function of the seven-day week that I think of as its most classically modern feature.
The week is weird. That's historian and author David Henkin, and we'll continue this conversation about the history of the modern seven-day week here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. Thanks for being with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and this is The Morning Show. Now, let's get back to the evolution of the seven-day week. I recently talked with David Henkin. He's the author of the book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. And here's the second part of that conversation. Let's go back to, for a moment, if we could, the role of imperialism and colonialism and how you see that, David, defining and instilling the seven-day week.
All right, so imperialism and colonialism are powerful forces in the spread of timekeeping technologies. In the case of the week, though, it's a little complex. So, for example, European imperial powers impose new calendars on their various colonial territories. Some of those colonial territories already observed the seven-day week. So I'll give you one sort of obvious example. In the Muslim Mediterranean world, in North Africa, the imposition of a Gregorian solar calendar onto a Muslim lunar calendar was the occasion for great conflict and confusion and resistance. But the use of the seven-day week was seamless because both of those societies counted a seven-day week and agreed on where we were within the cycle, even if they didn't necessarily use the week for the same purposes. In other places, like in East Asia, military conquest, imperial expansion, and especially the spread of Western capitalism introduced a week in lands that had never counted continuous cycles of 7 days. You'll see a much bigger change for in places like Japan and China, which were not formally colonized in the same way than you would in places like Egypt or Iraq.
David Henkin, our guest, he is the author of the new book, The Week, A History of the Unnatural Rhythms That Made Us Who We Are. He's a historian at UC Berkeley. And David, how has this week technology, how has this been able to persevere throughout time? How has it been able to, throughout the 19th century and all the other technologies that have developed, how has it persevered?
There are a lot of remarkable things about it. One is that none of the societies that have counted seven-day weeks have ever disagreed about where we are, like what phase of the cycle we're in. That's a remarkable, given how many conflicts there have been, even within societies about calendars and timekeeping, that the week seems to have created a common ground within and across those societies that have observed it. Maybe the more obvious mystery of the week is how it has survived very powerful and in many ways reasonable attempts to remove it. So I'll give you three examples. These are the three most famous assaults on the week. One took place in the late 18th century, and it was in the French Revolutionary calendar, which sought to replace the seven-day week with a 10-day, what they called a decade, a 10-day cycle of time. It would be completely independent of, obviously, the seven-day week. That was designed in large part to undermine the power of the Catholic Church in France. Within a few years, it was clear that the French populace was not getting rid of its seven-day week, or for that matter, its weekly patterns of church attendance. The second famous example would be another revolution. So fast forward from the 1790s to the 19-teens and 20s in the Soviet Union, where the Bolsheviks, also interested in undermining the power of an entrenched Christian church, in that case, the Russian Orthodox Church, made calendar reforms, serious calendar reforms, many of which were successful. This one was not. What they first tried to do was create a five-day week and then a six-day week. And what they wanted to do was, in some ways, even more radical, they wanted to make a staggered, a non-coordinated week, so that not everyone would have the same day off. This was designed also to create continuous production in Soviet factories, and it too failed after a couple of years. And the seven-day week returned there as well. The third example is less well known, but is at least as interesting, and that is in the capitalist West, led by businesses in the United States, but embraced by reformers in Europe and in North America. There was a plan to just tweak the week in a very small way, not to change its length and not to to break its coordination. In other words, not to stagger it across the population, but just to make it fit into months and especially years. So several companies, most famously the Kodak Corporation, introduced a new calendar for all of its internal purposes. And calendars like that became the model for an international calendar reform movement that sought basically to introduce a 364-day year with extra days at the end. And those extra days, either one or two, depending on whether it was a leap year, would have no place in the weekly cycle.
It's a day without a day of the week?
Exactly. One or two days that are what you might call extra hebdomadal. Right? They stand outside the seven. Now, it's not that weird if you think about it. We do it all the time with holidays. We still call Monday of Labor Day Monday, and the next day is Tuesday. But Monday doesn't feel like a Monday when it's Labor Day, and Tuesday doesn't feel like a Tuesday from the perspective of the work week if it falls after Labor Day. But we still go ahead with our count. But what this calendar reform sought to do was to go from, let's say, Friday, December 31st to a holiday, mm-hmm. and then the next day would be Saturday, January 1st. And if you did that, then January 1st would be Saturday every year in perpetuity. Huh. So you wouldn't have all these problems. You wouldn't need a new calendar each year. You could organize the months there so they'd have the same number of weeks. Every year would have the same number of working days. It made a lot of sense, and it didn't seem to cause such a problem. I mean, the French Revolution wanted to go to a 10-day week. That was a big change. The Russian Revolution wanted to have people have assigned to different weekly calendars. That's really complicated. All this reform wanted to do was to add one or two days a year that stood outside the week. And there are lots of reasons to think that these reforms would pass, because they were embraced by the same people who were talking about things like having time zones, having international agreement about where the dateline was, having moving the clocks forward an hour in the summer and then reverting back in the winter. All these things that we do, right?
Right.
They all succeeded. The one thing that didn't succeed was this reform.
David, so with your research and with your book, The Week, I have to ask, is the concept of the seven-day week becoming obsolete? And if not, should it be?
Well, I think the history of the week in the last 200 years would suggest the opposite, that far from becoming obsolete, it has become universal and much more entrenched. There are some developments in the last 20 to 30 years that might suggest that it's weakening its grip on us. Some of the obvious ones would be things like remote work or synchronized work across the dateline. So all these things that make it less crucial to schedule activities by day of the week and make it less obvious what day of the week it is for all of us. Another one that we sometimes underestimate is the decline of synchronized entertainment. For many people, certainly in my generation and generations prior, the character of each day of the week was shaped by what was on TV,
right,
or shaped by movies or shaped by radio programming or things of that sort. That is, of course, no longer the case. We are raising generations of people who consume their entertainment almost entirely asynchronously, with the significant exception of sports. So there are reasons to think that the week is might be less important 20 years from now than it was 20 years ago. And yet it really does seem entrenched. And my research suggests that the week is very, very hard to change and seems almost impossible to extirpate, to uproot. I found no examples of societies that abandoned the 7-day week. And all of our complaining during the pandemic about Blur's Day, you know, the week is this day, that day, the other day, all those things suggest to me that we are far more attached to the week than I would have thought before the pandemic. I would have thought maybe the pandemic would have shown that with our electronic calendars and our asynchronous entertainment and our remote working, that we don't really need the week anymore. That really is kind of an artifact of industrial society, not post-industrial society. But all that complaining that we all did, myself included, about what day of the week it was, suggested to me that it is very, very hard to shake the mental habits that have grown up around the week, both individually and collectively as a society.
David Henkin, thank you for giving us the time to stop and consider the week.
Thank you. Lovely to talk to you, Lee.
You know, our 7-day week is just one topic of conversation on the morning show. And I would ask you, this whole team would like to know from you, where would you like us to go next? Where should we go deep and slow down and investigate and dig around? Who would have thought about the 7-day week? We did. And, you know, with your suggestions. So what would you like us to cover and what would you like to weigh in on? Share your conversation ideas with us anytime by visiting WPR.org/mornings. There you can listen to recent discussions, share your ideas for future programs, listen to some old ones, submit a 2-question super easy form. You can also send program ideas our way via email anytime at ideas@WPR.org. And thank you for participating. Join us tomorrow morning at 7:30 for the president of the Alliance for the Great Lakes and hear their warning about our outdated sewage systems. What's happening to our lakes, both great and small, deserve our investigation, and we'll do that tomorrow morning after 7:30 with you. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent today, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.